Good morning. So I did my preparations, and then this morning something went through my mind that had to be said first, and so everything's a little disrupted, which is fine. What went through my mind was a memory. So the subject of this talk is offering. And what I suddenly remembered was a time, quite a long time ago, when I had the thought of dedicating the merit of my day's practice every day. I can think of two times that I did that. And I remember the second one more. I was living at San Francisco Zen Center, and there were things happening in the world that I wanted to be involved with, but I couldn't. Political things of some sort. And since I couldn't, the way I found to offer my support to the world that was not directly in front of me was to dedicate the merit at the end of each day. And what I noticed about that was it changed the quality of the day. And I think I'm going to start doing that again, because if with every action I take, I think, oh, I'm generating something, this is my gift, this is my offering to the world, I might want to make a better offering. So that's a thing I had to add. I have been, you might or might not be able to tell from the introduction, I've been a little bit of a renegade. I've spent just about half my life in Zen now, which is the kind of exciting mile marker. But I owe this life, which has really given me everything I have, to two small, somewhat trivial details about Minnesota Zen Center at the time I entered. The first one was that before I got there, somebody went through the chant book and removed all the sexist language. So I did not encounter the generic he anywhere. I did not encounter patriarchs. I encountered something that was not offensive to me as a very serious feminist at the time. Things like that don't bother me anymore, but I would be interested in them because they keep people away. And the second one was the statue on the altar was a little smaller than this one. There were not giant, ornate, flowery things everywhere. There was not an 8-foot golden Buddha statue. I think I would have run away screaming. So I have thought about the thing about the language, and I've been grateful. I think I know who the women were who pushed that change and the men who participated in it. But I had not thought much about the statues and the robes and the ornate stuff. When I went to San Francisco Zen Center, it escalated seriously as to how many rules there were and how much fussiness and how big the statues were. But by then I was hooked and I just accepted it. But for my last training and my current existence, I'm in the Antaiji style, the just sitting, sishin without toys. Really zazen is what matters. So that's the beginning of this. And I am currently exploring the other side of our practice. And now let me ask, how many people are like pretty new? Okay, so I'll try, wave at me if I say something incomprehensible. So one of the things that we also do in Zen is we do chanting. we just did a little, we'll do a little more. How many people go to services here? Okay, great. So you have the experience I'm talking about. And I specifically want to talk about the Dharanis, or the magical chants, which supposedly actually make things happen, which is a little funny, because our practice is not about making external things happen. And then I go back to another very, like in my first few months of Zen practice, I had a friend who was in Soka Gakkai. When she discovered that I was interested in Buddhism, she got very excited and had to explain to me what the true Buddhism was. And it all had to do with the Lotus Sutra, which I had to read. She said, you don't have to read it, just chant. I had to read it. I was not ready for the Lotus Sutra. I went and talked with Roshi about it. He laughed. But the curious thing was, the basic practice was to chant the title of the Lotus Sutra, Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. That's the way they said it anyway. Which means I take refuge in the law of cause and effect. And it was helpful to me to have a translation of it. I took a trip. I drove from Minneapolis to Cleveland, Ohio, during a blizzard. It was the kind of blizzard that we have sometimes where you see lots of cars off the road on the side, and there aren't many cars left on the road, and they've closed the freeway. And so I just kept driving until I was running out of gas, and then I got off, and by then the freeway was open. But what I did during this, because this had just happened, was I was chanting Nam-myoho Renge Kyo the whole way. So I didn't know that people were dying on that road. I might have stopped and tried to help somebody. But I got there 2 hours early. I not only got there 2 hours early, but for the rest of the time that was my habitual road, that drive was 2 hours shorter. And I don't still chant the Lotus Sutra or the title of the Lotus Sutra. I don't. But it was sort of an impressive experience in Dharanis and in the power of chanting. A couple of other things, the Heart Sutra, which basically describes the nature of reality. It's all about emptiness. It didn't become famous until a certain incident. This is Red Pine's commentary on the Heart Sutra. So he says, the Heart Sutra is the best known of the thousands of scriptures in the Buddhist canon. Its fame, though, is relatively recent in terms of Buddhist history and didn't begin until 1,000 years after the Buddha's nirvana. And then some other stuff. So there was a refugee, a Buddhist novice, still in his teens. One day this novice befriended a man who was impoverished and ill, and the man in turn taught him the words of the Heart Sutra. Not long afterward, the novice was ordained a monk, and some years later he embarked on a great journey. His name was Xuang Zang, and he set out on the Silk Road for India in search of answers to questions concerning the Buddha's teaching that this world is nothing but mind. He's said to have traveled 10,000 miles. Again and again, he turned to the Heart Sutra to ward off demons, dust storms, and bandits. When he finally returned to China in 645, he was welcomed back by the emperor, and stories about the power of the Heart Sutra began making the rounds. So the Heart Sutra, chanted as a magical text, is how we came to have the Heart Sutra as like probably our most commonly chanted offering. The Heart Sutra involves Avalokiteshvara, and it describes the nature of reality. the Lotus Sutra, one of the other big texts, describes the nature of reality, and it's really, really flowery. I find it challenging. The Dahishin Dharani, which, how many people are familiar with that? Okay. Is completely a song in praise of Avalokiteshvara. And this is one for, quite a while now. I chant it every day at home, at my place of practice. My teacher chanted, it was the Heart Sutra and the Dahishin Dharani, and that's what I do. At San Francisco Zen Center every day, Tassajara twice a day, at Minnesota Zen Center during Sesshin. And it's a Dharani, which means it's a magical chant. And when we do chants, we offer the merit of them to a whole list of causes, beings. We offer it back to the Buddha and to the lineage and to the whole world and to the temple. And I did. One of the longer dedications, one of the standard dedications goes, may all awakened beings manifest through the three treasures, their luminous mirror wisdom. Having chanted the Dharani of great compassion, we dedicate its merit and virtue to Buddha, Bodhidharma, Dogen, all the ancestors, Dharma protecting devas and saints and earth spirits and monastery protecting spirits. We pray for peace in the land, harmony among nations, prosperity and longevity for donors, tranquility within a monastery, ample sustenance for the community. And it goes on. And we offer for deceased monks and for people who are sick. And I've added a bunch of things to it for my own use. And it says, may they equally perfect awakening. May all beings perfect awakening. So this is, in our culture of Buddhism, considered to be beneficial to chant all these words. I found a translation, but I don't think I'll read it because I think I'll run out of time. Chanting words of praise to the three treasures, and particularly to Avalokiteshvara, who embodies compassion. Here. You are luminous with shining wisdom. You transcend the world. Oh, Lion King, great Bodhisattva, remember, remember this heart. Act, act, realize, realize, continue, continue. Victor, great victor. There's about two pages of magnificent words like that. And what we say about this, or what I've been taught about it, is that when we do this, we're creating merit. And what we do when we create merit is we give it away. Because we're kind of, there's this kind of mechanistic feeling about merit. And so we say, well, yeah, we're creating merit, but we're not keeping it. We're dedicating it to the whole thing that makes this work. So we're sending it back to the Buddhas and ancestors who make us, who give us what we have here, who make this whole thing possible. And then we also give it away here and there. It's like on the altar back there, there's names of people who are being supported by our chanting. So now I want to look at this thing of making merit from an outside perspective. I've been reading non-Buddha sources. I've been particularly reading someone named Martine Prechtel, who is half Native American, grew up on the Pueblo Reservation, and spent several years in a Mayan village in Guatemala, and was trained to be a shaman. They drafted him. he didn't go there looking for that. And he talks about a way of seeing the universe that, so I'm going to talk some about this, and then I'm going to go back to Zen and try to tie these two, try these things together. So, come on. Oh, there it is. Okay. So he's just finished a description of the clothes that people wear when they go farming. He says, they go beautiful, they wear beautiful clothes, they make their tools beautiful. They make their homes beautiful, they make their bodies beautiful, and they make their farm fields beautiful. And then he does some descriptions of that. And then he says, people all descend from the indigenous, and indigenous people are intent on feeding the divine in everything they do, by walking down the trail, working, eating, and sleeping, by the earth-oriented ingenuity of human-made beauty. For after all, that's what all we really have to give as a gift that the holy didn't already make. What, when we live, the way we live is our gift. It's like, that's why I had to say that thing that kind of came to me those years ago, because it's like, oh, here it is. And he speaks very eloquently about it. And he says, what we have to offer, our gift to the creation of the universe, to the moment-by-moment creation of the universe, our gift is, can be beauty, chance, songs, beautiful clothes. So I'm not going to come back to it. I'm going to do it as I go along. So suddenly, to wear a robe that I sewed with my own hands, and to do three prostrations, offer incense, say a chant before beginning sewing, and saying a verse with every stitch. Suddenly, this thing which I've known, I felt it. I felt it. After sewing my robes, I just kept sewing by hand. And I sewed and chanted things. And I made a quilt that I gave to my daughter that was full of chants and blessings that I sewed. This is indigenous. Nobody ever told me why we did things. You know, it's like, don't ask why. Just do them, and then you'll find out why. But so here is this person who has told me, why? Why did I sew every stitch? Why did I chant with every stitch? Why did I do those prostrations before and after chanting? I have run across people who sewed their robes while watching football. And it felt kind of horrifying, but the kind of horrifying that it is the horrifying about being disconnected. I didn't have it then, but now it's like, of course, the way we relate to the earth, we receive her gifts and we give back. And when Martine says the holy, it's like, so what do you know? What's not holy, you know? There's nothing that's not holy. There's desecrated. There's lots of desecrated. But there's nothing that's not holy. And so that this is not allowed to touch the ground, and that it has to have this little case to carry it in, and I have to have that thing to help it not touch the ground when I bow, and the fact that I bow. All of these things, they come... They call us back to a way of life that our civilization doesn't know. I mean, this is my entry to the indigenous. This is my, I hope I'm not offending anyway. I'm so excited about having found this, making art, making songs, making beauty. That is the way we keep the universe going. I didn't print it out, but in Bendowa, there is I meant to, but I truly didn't. Okay. When you sit down in this way, everything in the entire universe is coming forth to support you. And you, in turn, are supporting everything. I really wish I could, retrieve the words and recite them to you. But that is the nature of it, and I think it's why I love that text so much. It's like, oh, we're part of it. We are part of this magnificent, beautiful thing called interdependent origination. And here we have to go. We see, maybe Japanese people don't have to go, and maybe, you know, people who grew up in a Buddhist country don't have to. But as an American, I have to listen to other cultures to understand this. It's like my cultural conditioning is so thick. Of course, our love, our prayers, our chanting, our just sitting, our gifts of kindness, our actions make the world work. I met somebody once whose job it was to offer a sacred pipe every morning to make the sun come up. And the civilized mind says, oh, that's cute. That's quaint. But actually, we've been not living this way for a while, and look what's happening. And so that's how I became an activist that nobody can tell is an activist, because the activism I do is talking to trees. Sometimes I try to get other people to come and talk to them with me, or listen to them. Okay, so I have another little reading. So the last piece of this book is things called Keeping Our Agreement with the Wild. And he says that when humans started farming rather than, you know, foraging and stuff, we did something. You know, you cut down a forest and you plant corn. And so we had to make deals. We had to make agreements with wild nature. And we're violating those agreements all the time now. But he has a suggestion for how we, just living here in cities and everything, can start to keep, can come back to keeping our agreement with the wild. And where he says the wild, he could say the holy, and we could say Dharmakaya, you know, the whole universe Buddha. So here's one. Kneel at the feet of the mother of the food you eat and ask her to adopt you. The meal chant, as I learned it, said, innumerable labors have brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us. As we receive this offering, we should consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. And I like that, because it's like, it's obvious. How could our virtue ever, how could I ever do anything to exchange or to compensate or to justify the enormous gifts of all that brings me food, You know, you start with the soil and the seed and the rain and the sun and the earth, and then you have somebody weeding and you have somebody planting and you have somebody harvesting. And even if I did all those things myself, it's still a gift of the soil, of the microbes and the fungi in the soil, of sun and rain. And I grow plants inside, and it's like those are really important. Trying to do it all yourself is just not undoable. We are automatically indebted, and we automatically cause suffering. And he says, oh, if you live in the modern world and aren't growing food somehow, then someone or something is starving on account of you while you take up space and nutrients. He doesn't mind saying extreme things. Stop living in coffee shops and get out under the leaf litter. The holy is not being fed by your sitting around thinking about it. Even so, in the end, nobody can truly carry their own weight alone. We must help one another with the inefficient beauty of food and the majestic learning of this growth. When you consider what just one citified human this day and age takes out of the holy earth to support them for 5 minutes, a thinking person could despair. But that kind of despair is just laziness with a college education. If you carry well just even a small chunk of that weight, it will be more help than you can estimate. When I left Sanshinji to go out on my own, I had a vow that I was going to grow food. My intention was to grow enough food to support more people than myself, which I'm not even close. It's like I keep doing other things. But to carry even a small chunk of that weight. We do what we can. Oh. And when you garden or farm, then you have to remember that when you harvest, there is no difference between pulling off a ripe ear of corn for the stalk and cutting the throat of a lamb to eat the meat. Living things on this earth live only because of the death and generosity of other living things. No one is more evolved because they eat only vegetables. Don't fool yourself into thinking that by only eating plants you are lessening the suffering of living beings, because you think plants are non-sentient. To indigenous peoples worldwide, plants are the most sentient beings of all and should be respected as much as any animal should. They just have a larger, more temporally spread out nervous system than most humans can sense, which can be better measured geologically in eons instead of minutes, millennia instead of days, and by synaptic wave patterns like the rippled growth of stalactites in a cave. The entire world suffers for the rest of the world to thrive. It's all about generosity. It is about not escaping a life where suffering is how things work. Have you heard this before? Life contains suffering. So, and then this is like, I mean, the whole book is kind of a prose poem. And I'm tempted to read lots, but oh, I might be able to go back and read more. Okay. Oh. Then I stumbled across Braiding Sweetgrass, which was written pretty locally. And I was told it was fabulous. I read it. And here we go. In the Western tradition, there is a recognized hierarchy of beings, with, of course, the human being on top, the pinnacle of evolution, the darling of creation, and the plants at the bottom. But in native ways of knowing, human people are often referred to as the younger brothers of creation. We say that humans have the least experience with how to live, and thus the most to learn. We must look to our teachers among the other species for guidance. Their wisdom is apparent in the way they live. They teach us by example. They've been on the earth far longer than we have been and have had time to figure things out. They live both above and below ground, joining sky world to the earth. Plants know how to make food and medicine from light and water, and then they give it away. I like to imagine that when Sky Woman scattered her handful of seeds across Turtle Island, she was sowing sustenance for the body and also for the mind, emotion, and spirit. She was leaving us teachers. The plants can tell us her story. We need to learn to listen. And plants as teachers reminds me, a friend of mine makes flower essences. And when I've taken a couple of his classes, and he says, people ask him, you know, and he says, oh, really, it's the plants as teachers. He's in kind of a European pagan tradition or something like that. Oh, there's Bendoa. Need to pause for just a moment. So, once upon a time, I developed a theory about where Buddhism came from. This was after reading a particular life of the Buddha, which I do not own, and I don't know which one it was, and I'm sad about that. But it described the culture that the Buddha grew up into, and it seemed like a very lovely culture. And I developed the theory that Buddhism was a way of transmitting the jewels from that earth-based culture, deeply rooted in spirit, completely giving, receiving, giving, receiving, giving. I mean, there's not even a separation, but completely enmeshed in it's all gift, it's all offering. That Buddhism is a transmission into the Aryan culture, which was quite warlike and patriarchal, and into our culture, that they took some of the understandings and hid them. So that what I talked about sowing this and about chanting and about making vows, it's a way, it creates its own culture for us. And it's a culture that can get along with the capitalist world in which we live, externally or visibly, and yet it's deeply different. It deeply changes us. It makes us part of the whole. And thus Buddhism has lasted a long time and it's been helpful to many people and it changes shapes wherever it goes. But we have this key thing. I listened to a talk at a conference, the priest's conference, by a woman who is studying modern Buddhism and commenting on our idea here that there's something that we would call core Buddhism. This is not, Zen doesn't do this so much, but she was studying all Buddhists. And it's like separating the cultural stuff. And we just have this thing that's about sitting and mindfulness and so forth. And she said, actually, that's cultural too. Stripping away everybody else's cultural elements leaves us to project our elements and think they're universal. That shook me up as being a person who didn't like the cultural elements. But look at what we do. So we have this flowery language. And sometimes the language is in other languages. You'd be surprised how many people can chant that whole thing. That's the Dahishan Dharani without looking at a text. You just do it often enough and there it is. And those who are interested in such things say it's the sounds that create something. It's the sounds that matter. Very difficult language, very, very poetic language. Every time I study a Mahayana text, I have to struggle because 90% of it is flowery language and you can't find the plot. The Lotus Sutra has no plot. You have to go into the flowery language and find the meaning in there. So we have special robes. Some people are wearing rakasus. Everybody took their shoes off. There's this rule. I mean, I not only can't wear the okesa into the bathroom, I can't wear the karomo into the bathroom. It's like you have to practically completely change your clothes to use the toilet. And I was always annoyed and I was puzzled. And of course, on the one hand, the toilet is symbolic of impurity, and removing waste is a ritual thing. But really, you know, you walk into our bathrooms back there, you shouldn't have to take stuff off. It's totally symbolic. I have finally saw in Korea, I saw the bathroom for which this rule was designed. And it was really helpful to me to see that there was once a practical rule for taking our stuff off before we use the toilet. There was a slit on the floor. And you step over the slit and you do what you're going to do. All these rules, all these special. I remember somebody, I think it was Yuko Kano, said, wearing the robes and taking care of them the way they're supposed, you almost have no time to do anything else. It takes all your attention just to wear them properly, including not touching things, including, like, I'm not supposed to sit on the back of my okesa. And you know, so you learn how to do that. Don't let it get rained on. But don't cover it with stuff either. That's why you see monks with umbrellas rather than raincoats. It makes you give attention to the sacred. That's what all these things are. The altar, look, we have flowers, we have incense, and then we have our substitute for incense, which I need, I'm allergic. Let me see, and we have a candle, and we have a representation of the holy. And we behave in a special way when we come around the altar. And everything in here is like beautiful and quiet and helps your mind go, shh, calm down, relax. And all of this is recognized by this person who I don't think has any background in Zen. But it's recognized by a person who says, well, Indigenous people just naturally, you know, they wear their best clothes to go out and farm. You don't wear your old clothes because farming is holy. So I'm currently studying this. I'm looking at my clothes and going, what am I going to wear when I go out to the orchard? And what are my actions going to be? And so the vision, he gave me a vision of Buddhist life. Because earth, grasses and trees, fences and walls, tiles and pebbles, all things in the Dharma realm in 10 directions carry out Buddha work. Therefore, everyone receives the benefit of wind and water movement caused by this functioning, and all are imperceptibly helped by the wondrous and incomprehensible influence of Buddha to actualize the enlightenment at hand. these various influences do not mix into the perceptions of this person sitting, because they take place within stillness without any fabrication, and they are enlightenment itself. All of this magnificent, suffering, beautiful, terrible world is all enlightenment itself. And I talked longer than I thought, but we still have some moments for questions. Any questions? Or comments? Okay, one, two. The book that I was reading from, The Unlikely Peace at Kuchumakik, which is from an incident described where he and some other people were trying to bring food to some people who everything had been destroyed by an earthquake. And when they got there, the people had been hungry for at least a week. They found that people respectfully took, they had hats. Everybody got, for each family, a thing of rice and a thing of beans, and then the father would take it back and share it with the family. And that people did not think that it was a terrible thing. They thought it was a wonderful thing because they had come to the holy place. That's why there were thousands of them there. They had intentionally come to the holy place to die together in a holy place. I was like, that's a model we might need someday. But I was like, wow. And he was astounded by it. He thought they needed his help.
So if you grow food for pollinators and birds, does that qualify a little bit? That's more of my focus in my urban garden.
Uh-huh.
I do a little bit of tomatoes, but
uh-huh.
I'm very focused on native bees and butterflies.
And what's the mind that causes you to do that? What's the intention?
Their survival and thinking that they're really beautiful and fascination. Mm-hmm. I've also taken close-up photographs of pollinators when they're on flowers.
Oh, yeah. So you're
really, and it's creative too, just gardening. But
yeah.
I love birds. I love
them. Yeah. So you're making an offering to other beings of the planet.
Yeah. So I consider them beings.
Yeah. So I don't know what Martine would say, but I hear that you're making an offering.
Mm-hmm. How much do you think the connection that we can make to Native and Indigenous cultures through Buddhism can help us improve our lives, and how much does it feed our idea that we are civilized? And that it's our superiority that allows us to see that Indigenous people are good, so we can know.
Oh, dear.
Do you see what I'm saying?
What a horrible thought. It's wise to think of that, yeah. Yeah, I suppose I could think that I'm better than my neighbors, the right-wingers, because I have this opening. It would be good for me to learn not to feel better. The culture he describes is one in which people don't feel better than other individuals. But, I mean, civilization has got to go. I don't know if that answers it all. Let me start by saying that in my advertising I tell the truth about myself. And I find that it attracts people who want what I have to offer rather than what some... I used to try to be regular, and that really didn't work very well. And a lot of people actually want some spiritual nourishing and stuff like that. So that's the starting place. In the work itself, I don't know. It's like I just have human relationships with people. I'm thinking, so I'm in private practice, and if you're in a clinic or hospital, it's like much tougher. But every person is a person. I don't know. Ask some more.
I feel very, like you talked about holy, like in everything that we do, I feel like there's a holy experience that happens when I'm sort of holding space to hear that stuff.
Yes. The holy space that happens when you're holding space for the person who is considered to be your client. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Maybe one more question? Okay. Thank you.
The closing chant is on the front of our bulletin.